Harry read it and weep. The GOP takes the Senate and adds to the House and the governors. As for the Democratic comeback, not this year. From WAMU 88.5 and coming to you from the studios of New Hampshire Public Radio in Concord, New Hampshire, I'm Ken Rudin, and this is The Political Junkie.
You like Ike, I like Ike, everybody likes Ike
for president.
Add Ike to you, add Ike to me, I don't care how you quote it.
Come on and vote for Kennedy, and we'll come out on top.
Vote for Richard Nixon and Henry Cabot Lodge, cause they're the ones to lead the USA.
Thanks for joining us this week for episode 50 of The Political Junkie, a program covering the issues, the candidates, the horse race, the history, the trivia, and now and then a rare insert of humor. No matter what, it's all politics. I'm Ken Rudin, joining you from the nation's first presidential primary state. But let's not get ahead of ourselves. We have the next 14 months to talk Iowa and New Hampshire. Now it's time to catch our breath. Tuesday was a rough night for Democrats, and an exhilarating one for Republicans. And not just in the Senate. In the House, where Republicans added to their lead, and the governorships, which proved to be a better day for the grand old party than even the most optimistic partisan predicted. Welcome to the Political Junkie post-game show. Also, we'll look back both at the life of Boston Mayor Tom Menino and at a legendary and heated TV debate over trade policy. It doesn't get better than that at the Political Junkie. Since this is the Political Junkie, let's start with some election night trivia. We've got our first elected black senator to the South since Reconstruction. That's South Carolina Republican Tim Scott. And our first ever black female Republican elected to the House, Mia Love in Utah. Rhode Island has elected its first female governor, Democrat Gina Raimondo. Iowa sent its first woman to Congress, Republican Joni Ernst, elected to the Senate. Speaking of the Senate, Republicans elected their first senator from West Virginia since 1956. The GOP's longest Senate losing streak nationwide is over. And Pennsylvania saw its governor go down to defeat. That hasn't happened since 1854. But before we go on, it's time for this week's trivia question. We're in New Hampshire, so here goes. Democrat Jean Shaheen bucked the GOP tide and was re-elected to her Senate seat. It was her fifth statewide win, two for the Senate and three before that as governor. What woman has won the most statewide election victories? Send your answer to trivia at krpoliticaljunkie.com. We'll select a winner at random from the bunch. The winner will get a fabulous vintage Political Junkie button. Again, that's trivia at krpoliticaljunkie.com. And there's no need to ever wait for the weekly trivia question. Hop over to the Political Junkie page on Facebook. We post a trivia question for fans only every Wednesday. And there's other great stuff on the page, too. That's The Political Junkie on Facebook. We're the one with the button. We'll give you the answer to last week's trivia question later in the show. The battle for control of the Senate was always going to be about the map. And the map showed that many of the Democrats up for re-election this year were those in red states that Barack Obama lost in 2012, sometimes by huge margins. Throw in the president's falling favorable polling numbers and a better class of GOP candidates, and you have the perfect storm to make Mitch McConnell the majority leader. But it was always supposed to be close. We thought the Republicans were going to win enough seats to give them the majority, but we didn't know if they would squeak in or they would win in a rout. But then came the election results one by one. West Virginia, Arkansas, Colorado, South Dakota, Iowa, Montana, North Carolina. It was pretty breathtaking. Even Virginia, which is yet to be called. I mean, Democrat Mark Warner may ultimately win this thing, but while nobody thought Virginia was going to be close, let alone this close. And let's not fail to mention Republican pickups in the House, as well as some surprising victories in the governor's contests. We start the show with two Republicans who've watched this kind of drama for years. They've both had their good nights and their bad nights. I suspect Tuesday was a good night. Ed Rollins, Republican campaign consultant, national campaign director for Reagan Bush in 1984, Jack Kemp in 1988, and Mike Huckabee in 2008. Ed, welcome to the Political Junkie.
Thank you. Pleasure.
And joining me here in the studio at NHPR is Steve Dupre. He's the Republican National Committeeman for New Hampshire and the former state GOP chair. Steve, thanks for joining us.
Glad to be here.
Steve, what's your initial takeaway from Tuesday's results?
Well, it was a great night overall. It wasn't a mandate. It was a lot of hard-fought individual battles that stayed close, quite close, until the very end, but then broke our way. I do think in most of those Senate races, our successful candidates were able to make it a referendum on President Obama. Here in New Hampshire, I think but for the fact that Scott Brown had recently become a full-time resident of New Hampshire and Senator Shaheen reminded everybody of that at every turn, but for that, he would have won here as well. So, you know, I heard from my Democratic friends that it was just a sour mood in the country, that they hated all politicians. But the fact that we were not only able to hold all those governorships except for Corbett in Pennsylvania, but actually add to them sort of disproves that theory. It was a good night.
Ed Rollins, was it Obama's unpopularity or was it a good class of Republican candidates or was it a combination of the two?
I think it was all of the above. I think the one thing that we did, with all due respect to my good friend Steve, you know, we learned our lessons from the last go around. We had good candidates. They were well funded. We had some of the best mechanics. We went head to head with the best of the Democrats. We had a great ground game everywhere. We had some superior candidates who fought hard. Even Senator Roberts was a little behind, and people thought it was a dead man walking. Basically, picked it up the last couple months, took some advice from some top-notch players, and ran a great race to take that one across the victory line. So I couldn't be more pleased. And I think the argument against it being red states for the only thing up. We won 8 of the 9 governorships that were basically in states that Obama carried. Whoever thought we'd win Illinois, Massachusetts, Michigan, Wisconsin,
Maryland. I mean, exactly. I mean, we talk about maybe some of these senators, Democratic senators who went down were in these red states that Romney carried in 2012. But Republicans won the governorship in Illinois, in Maryland, Massachusetts, states where President Obama's numbers are not that terrible.
Well, let me tell you another statistic. And you're a great guy on statistics. We have, in my lifetime, I'm 71 years old, we have more Republicans in the Congress than ever in my lifetime. And whatever the number is 243, whatever it ends up being, 247, 248. Reagan's landslides, Eisenhower's landslides, Nixon's landslides, we've never had that many Republicans in the Congress. And what I would argue with this thing, like 210, where I think a lot of people misinterpret it, this election went deep. We got a lot of legislative, even in New York, which obviously is an overwhelmingly Democrat state, we took back the Republican state Senate. Our candidate, Rob Astorino, who was outspent 15-1 by Cuomo, basically got 41% of the vote, which is a good showing in the state. And I think to a certain extent, it just shows that we worked real hard in this election.
Let me ask you both this question, because you both have this experience. Ed, you were, of course, the campaign chairman of Reagan Bush in 1984 when the ticket won 49 states. And yet 2 years later, the Republicans lost control of the Senate. Steve, you New Hampshire is the ultimate wave state. They did great in 2004. They did terribly in 2006. They did great in 2010. They did poorly in 2012. And now, you know, and then here at 2014. As much as good of a night as you both had on Tuesday, I'll start with Steve. How long lasting is this? How long lasting can this be?
Well, like I said, it was a great night last night. My message to both here in New Hampshire, we also flipped our house and increased our – got the majority in the executive council and increased our Senate. My message to everybody is get to work. You can't beat something with nothing. And while we've been in the minority in the Senate and had a thinner majority in the United States House, the American people will either reward or punish – us and our presidential nominee in 2016, depending on whether we get stuff done. That doesn't mean we have to agree with President Obama. I think Senator McConnell said it right. Neither he nor the president are going to change their world or national viewpoints overnight. But I think we have to show the voters that we're not bickering, that we're actually passing legislation that impacts and affects their lives. And if we do that, I think we're well positioned. I think that's one of the reasons our incumbent Republican governors did well, with the exception of Corbett, and why we picked some up. They solve problems. That's what people want. So that's the task and challenge. If we do that and communicate it well, which is a separate problem we've had a lot of difficulty with, I think we'll be fine.
Ed, when you were running the Reagan campaign, I mean, as good as the Reagan-Bush ticket did in 1984, they didn't come close to getting a majority of the House. This is a different Republican Party in 2014, perhaps a more well-integrated into the country Republican Party than it was back in 84.
As you know, back in those days, the Democrats controlled the reapportionment process and obviously had drawn pretty severe lines in the 82 reapportionment. We picked up 14 seats in that 84 election. At this point, and that's the point I'm going to make, is we got the ball back. It's now our turn to run with the ball. We get to set the agenda. The president can either cooperate with us or he can veto it. He doesn't get to set the agenda, or at least doesn't get an agenda that's going to get passed. But I think the key thing here is the country wants the system to work, and we have the obligation now to put something forward, as Steve said, put something forward that basically makes sense, gets people back to work, helps the economy, and that we can communicate in a way that people believe in it. We can't be fighting the moral agenda. Those things are important to a lot of people. But at the end of the day, young people, if we want to attract them, ordinary people that are working, blue-collar workers, want the economy to get moving forward. And they keep saying it's the number one problem. That should be the number one focus.
Steve, about 12, 13 months ago, the Republican Party in the Congress, in the House, led the shutdown of the federal government, and it drove down Republican favorability numbers to single digits. And everybody said the 2014 election would be a referendum on the shutdown. The Republican brand is damaged. The Republican Party still has a ways to go with numbers as far as approval ratings, but considering what happened with the shutdown and considering what happened and go up to Tuesday night, I mean, that doesn't seem like a repudiation of the Republican Party.
No, when you stop hitting yourself, it feels good. And I think we've learned some lessons from some of our past legislative mistakes where it may have felt good philosophically to tangle with the president. We did damage our brand. We've done a good job rehabilitating it. But I think Ed is spot on. The average blue-collar guy who's out there working in New Hampshire doesn't like all the political ads, doesn't even like politicians. He wants to have this economy get going so he feels more secure, and he wants to also think he's in a safe world and we're sort of on top of the world situation. If we deliver on that, we can do fine. If we don't and we look like we're bickering and playing inside baseball, we're going to pay for it, and our presidential nominee will too in 2 years.
Coming from New Hampshire, you probably appreciate more than anybody else the difference between the Republican Party's tasks and accomplishments in 2014 and what awaits them in 2016, uniting behind a presidential candidate.
Yeah, this is going to be a tall order. We're going to have a competitive primary. The great thing about the New Hampshire primary is the party stays completely neutral and tries to make sure everybody, whether you're the least well-known, least well-funded candidate or the best, has a fair shot. So you leave here saying you like that process. But we're going to have a vigorous primary. We should. I think it's good. I think the number of debates will be reduced. I think the calendar will be reduced. Thank you, Reince Priebus. And we do, as you noted, have a much better, and Ed noted this, much better data management, much better ground game than we've had. We've learned from 2008 and 2012, and that credit goes to Reince Priebus. But it's going to be a vigorous battle, and Hillary Clinton is very popular here. The Clintons spend a lot of time here. They always had a lot of people down to Washington. They gave a lot of appointments, and it's going to be a tough battle in 2016 to have this go red, but I think we can do that.
Ed, do you get the sense that the Republicans are willing to work with the president the next 2 years?
On our agenda, I don't think we're going to basically take his agenda. I think we can deal with the topics. I think we can do immigration reform. I think we can tax reform. I think we do a lot of things. But it's going to be the Republicans' agenda, and obviously he's going to tell us what's acceptable, unacceptable. But it's not like we're going to basically take a 2,000-page bill like he did on health care and say, I don't need any of your votes, take it or leave it. That's not going to happen. And equally as important, I would hope that Boehner and McConnell will sit down and say, all right, Mr. President, this is what we want to do. What is your input? We don't want to get in the veto strategy here, but we will if we have to.
Steve, you were out on the road a lot with, I guess, John McCain and the 2014 midterms. What did you hear from voters? What did you learn? And what did you think is a lesson for the next 2 years?
Well, they're very unhappy with the president. They don't think the economy is working. They're not feeling it in their wallets. They're fearful about what's happening to America's stature around the world and realize that it impacts our security. And they want, as Ed said, they want to see things get done. They don't want to have – there are going to be some fights. But if the president will work with our agenda, I think we can accomplish things. And they want to see things done, like reform the tax code, make sure we have a competitive job environment, deal with immigration reform, things like that. So I think there's great opportunity here.
Are you optimistic about the next 2 years and about the party in the next 2 years?
I'm very optimistic. And a shout out, I think Reince Priebus has spent a lot of money helping bring our party up almost to par with the Democratic operation. And the real key question is, who's Ed supporting for president? Because we'll see him up here running a campaign, probably leading to victory, knowing his record.
Ed, how soon are you going to be up in New Hampshire?
I appreciate that very much. My wife will basically be with the divorce lawyer the moment I attach any candidate. I'm going to be on Fox commentating and talking about what a great job you've done building New Hampshire. But I will say this. I think that with all these great candidates, we've got four or five very significant governors and several senators that are going to run. We're going to end up with a candidate who may not be a front runner today, but will basically be a very viable. And Iowa, New Hampshire, South Carolina, I think you got to win two out of those first three. And New Hampshire's always been the roadmap to the nomination. So obviously, we'll all be up there watching.
Well, we'll have a party together.
Ed Rollins, the Republican campaign consultant, was the national campaign director for Reagan Bush in 1984. You can follow him on Twitter at Ed Rollins. Ed, thanks so much for joining us.
Take care. Bye-bye.
And Steve Dupre is the Republican National Committeeman for New Hampshire, the former state GOP chair. Steve, thank you, and we'll see you when 2016 really heats up.
That'll be in about a month, I think.
Maybe 2 days.
Yeah, exactly.
Thanks, guys. Mitch McConnell and the so-called establishment Republicans weren't the only ones with big stakes on election night. Lots of Tea Party-backed candidates were in tight spots in the days before November 4th. Now the House and the Senate are both red. What will conservatives hope to accomplish? And what will the current lineup mean for legislative action over the next couple of years? We've got Kevin Broughton on the line. He's the National Communications Director for the Tea Party Patriot Citizens Fund. Kevin, welcome back to the show.
Thanks a lot, Keenan. Always good to visit with you.
How do you feel about Tuesday's results? Good day for you guys?
Well, I tell you what, it was a pretty good day. It was a pretty good day, and obviously we backed a lot of candidates in primaries that didn't make it to the final round last evening. But in the last month or so leading up to the general, we got behind some of those candidates that we had even opposed in the primaries and got the vote out for them. At the end of the day, what was important was putting the brakes on a radical Obama agenda, and taking away Harry Reid's gavel and nuclear option was priority number one. So we're pleased with Tuesday's outcome.
One of the races I was we were all most fascinated about, but also fascinated with your role in was the Kansas Senate race. You have an incumbent senator, Pat Roberts, accused of being out of touch. He didn't live in the state. He really lived in Arlington, Virginia. The Tea Party Patriots Fund and other conservatives backed primary opponent to Roberts, and he got, I think, Milton Wolf, and he got some 41% of the vote. And then the Democrats drop out. The Democratic candidate drops out. An independent candidate steps up. And then everybody's saying, oh, my goodness, the Republican Party is going to lose a Senate race for the first time since 1932. How are you looking at the race?
Well, that was, that one kind of got everybody's attention when the Democrat dropped out and all of a sudden this sort of unknown guy, Greg Orman, a very wealthy, successful businessman and independent, a so-called independent, made some instant traction as soon as that race got reduced to two candidates instead of three. But honestly, Ken, there was probably some well-deserved panic on the Roberts side. I kept saying to myself, I just can't see Kansas electing a non-Republican to the Senate for the first time since 1932. But the fact of the matter is, we came out and endorsed Pat Roberts about 3 weeks ago. We paid for robocalls to go into the state, one by Ted Cruz and one by actor Nick Searcy from the show Justified. And so we got behind Pat Roberts, and it would have been just unthinkable for that state to flip from red to blue, and obviously the path to a majority would have gotten tougher. But I think it was just that, a little bit of panic on everybody's part. And I think that's evidenced by the way Sam Brownback, the governor, was reelected Tuesday as well.
There were some states where it was clear that, you know, you know how liberals in the media love to talk about Tea Party versus establishment, Republicans beating
right.
each other up. I mean, we live for that. You know that, okay?
Right.
That's clear. So, but I mean, there were at least two Republicans, and I'm thinking of Mitch McConnell in Kentucky, Tom Tillis in North Carolina. Neither candidate was a Tea Party favorite, but they won on Tuesday. How do you feel about the both the McConnell and the Tillis victories?
Well, you know, they both should be complimented, and North Carolina, Ken, was another state where we were out knocking on doors for Tom Tillis. You know, and we backed his challenger, Greg Brandon. We backed him hard. But again, that was too big an opportunity for a pickup for us not to be involved in it. As far as Mitch McConnell goes, you know, we congratulate the majority leader designate, but I think, and boy, we can discuss this some other time. A lot of the pollsters were off. It appears, I mean, that race wasn't close, and I don't think Senator McConnell was ever in any real peril in that deal. But impressive wins in two different ways for those two guys.
Two states that had Senate races, both Iowa and Arkansas. You had Joni Ernst winning in Iowa. You had Tom Cotton winning in Arkansas. They basically bridged the gap between so-called establishment and so-called Tea Party. They were conservative, backed by all factions of the party. Those two victories, Ernst in Iowa, Cotton in Arkansas, must have been very satisfying for you guys.
Absolutely. I mean, as a Southerner, I thought it would take a lot for Pryor to survive one more election. That and if he didn't have his daddy's last name and pedigree, he probably would have been gone 6 years ago. As far as Joni Ernst goes, that was just really thrilling and satisfying to watch. And she is a great candidate and a solid conservative. And we're going to look forward to working with her in the next Congress.
Any other people you're very impressed with who won on Tuesday?
Well, you know, there are really no bad victories on a night like Tuesday. What I would say is this, Ken. You know, we did a lot of polling during primary season among likely voters, and the top three issues every time, in varying order, were opposition to Obamacare, securing the southern border, and getting the national debt under control. And we saw that senators and members of Congress who ran on those issues won. We are gratified that a lot of the candidates who helped flip the balance of the Senate did so running on issues that we've been jumping up and down about all year long.
Of course, the big headlines in Tuesday's races was the victory of the Republicans to take control of the Senate. But I want to go back to at least one gubernatorial race, Scott Walker's victory in Wisconsin.
Yeah.
Scott Walker, I mean, became a national hero after the failed recall against him in 2011. He did not back away from conservative principles. And Wisconsin is certainly not a red state. It's purple at best, and it usually goes Democratic for president. What do you make of Scott Walker's victory on Tuesday, and what does it mean, if anything, for 2016?
Well, you know, I've all the media calls I do here lately, people have been asking me about 2016. I said, we got to get past Tuesday before I'm even allowed to think about that.
Yeah, but we've gotten past Tuesday. Now you're allowed to talk about it.
I know. And I'll tell you what, we're not, you know, this is not an institutional endorsement or anything like that. I got to say, though, in a state that is much bluer than it is red in Wisconsin, you're talking about a guy who has stood for three elections in 4 years. And won pretty comfortably. That guy's an up and comer, and I think you saw the ascension Tuesday night of a 2016 contender from Wisconsin and Governor Walker, and I'm thinking Paul Ryan might just ease. It's hard for me to see the two of them running in the same presidential primary, but I got to tell you, Scott Walker is impressive and is going to be a force to be reckoned with in 2016.
Kevin Broughton is the National Communications Director for the Tea Party Patriot Citizens Fund. Kevin, it was great to have you on the show again.
Always enjoy it, buddy. Take it easy.
Welcome back to The Political Junkie. I'm Ken Rudin. Democrats had a pretty slim chance of holding on to the Senate from the get-go. In the weeks leading up to Election Day, forecasts from the New York Times upshot to 538, to the Rothenberg Political Report, to Ken Rudin's Political Junkie, all predicted a Republican win. But that doesn't mean Democrats didn't have some silver linings on ballot measures and estate houses around the country. And 2016 isn't far away. But clearly, those Senate and gubernatorial losses on Tuesday were a big blow. So where do they go from here? Here to recap the battle is Igor Volsky. He's the managing editor of thinkprogress.org, an outlet of the Center for American Progress. He joins us now from CAP. Igor, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
Well, have you recovered from Tuesday's elections?
I have. It's been a slow process, but I think I'm there. You know, it was always going to be a hard year for Democrats. The math, the number of seats Democrats had to defend, and at a time when the president's approval ratings were as low as they are. So I think in many respects, you know, people predicted this kind of election. And now as folks are moving forward, all eyes are going to be on the lame duck session and, of course, on the big race in 2016.
Do you blame Tuesday's results on President Obama's popularity or lack thereof, or is it something bigger than that? Because the Democrats lost in pro-Obama states like Maryland and Massachusetts and Illinois, for example.
Well, President Obama's popularity certainly was a factor. It dragged down several candidates, but so was the slow economic recovery. Nationally, the unemployment rate may be inching downward, but in certain areas of the country, particularly in Arkansas and North Carolina, they're not seeing those effects. And so it was difficult for Democrats in those parts of the country to campaign and embrace Obama, and so they ran away from him. I think really what happened was you have an unpopular president, an economy that's not as booming as it should be, and a Washington that's broken, that voters have really turned their backs on. And because Obama is now in his second term, he's the incumbent, he's the guy in power, all of this is really blamed on him. And that's why voters rejected a lot of those Democratic incumbents and said, hey, Republicans, will give you a shot.
Some say that Democrats may have made a mistake by running away from Obama. Yes, the president is not popular. Yes, he was seen as a drag. But by running against Obama or even criticizing the president in some campaign ads, if nothing else, it hurt Democratic enthusiasm. It tamped down Democratic enthusiasm. Do you agree with that?
I mean, it certainly may have. You know, the president's decision to delay his immigration executive order, the relief he was going to provide to undocumented immigrants, may have dampened enthusiasm in states like Colorado that have a larger Hispanic population. Because if you look across the country, while you saw Democrats lose, you did see Democratic ideas win. Things like increasing the minimum wage, one in four different states, fairly conservative states. Voters shut down the radical personhood amendment in two states. Background checks for gun purchases passed in Washington state. So you had this interesting tension of voters voting out Democrats, but in some cases supporting what traditionally have been Democratic ideas.
I think Illinois is a good example of what you just said. The Democrats basically put the minimum wage, a non-binding question, on the Illinois ballot with the idea to bring out Democratic-leaning voters. And so you have the minimum wage passing sizably in Illinois, and yet the Democratic governor, Pat Quinn, goes down to defeat.
Well, and the president, you know, while he talked a lot about the minimum wage, it was certainly part of his platform, he never made a big push for it. I think there was a certain calculation made within the White House that, look, after 2012, we still have a split Congress, and the president felt that he had to find common ground with Republicans. So he, you know, didn't really kind of beat this issue too hard. And maybe, you know, some thinking goes, maybe if he would have, maybe if Democrats in some of those states, people like Mark Pryor, who waited a long time in Arkansas to embrace the minimum wage, maybe if he came around sooner, you would have had a different result, because those issues, no matter what party you're in, clearly, as we saw last night, those issues are winners.
What's your big headline? What's your big takeaway from Tuesday's elections?
The big headline for me is really the fact that Republicans won the majority, but they are calling for compromise with Obama. You saw on Tuesday night and early this morning, Republican leaders fan out on television programs and really concede the fact that there's no overarching platform that they ran this race on. There's no really big policy they're going to enact. And what they're saying now is, look, we need achievable goals. We need to find common ground with the president if we want to kind of brush up the Republican brand for 2016 and to sell ourselves to voters as a party that can actually get things done. Now, whether or not they hold on to that promise in a couple of days, we'll have to see. But ultimately, and I think this is what Democrats are also going to talk about, is voters are tired with a broken D.C., with these politicians bickering and fighting with each other all the time. Maybe now, 6 years into the Obama presidency that has really been marred by this kind of behavior, lawmakers finally got the message and they can work on some issues that really have a good deal of bipartisan support. Going issue by issue, you know, one of the big kind of initiatives that McConnell has talked about if he wins the majority, and now he has, of course, is declawing financial reform, what's commonly known as Dodd-Frank. And if Obama compromises on that, I think that's certainly an area where Elizabeth Warren is able to stand up to the president or any other Democrats who go along with trying to water down Wall Street reform and may lead some kind of effort against it. The other name, of course, that comes to mind is Senator Bernie Sanders from Vermont. He has hinted that he's exploring a presidential bid in 2016 to raise progressive issues that he thinks aren't being discussed in today's politics. And he, too, I think, is someone who could potentially kind of keep the left wing of the Democratic Party alive.
Of course, Bernie Sanders would first have to become a Democrat.
Well, yes, yeah, so he's an independent, but caucuses with the Democrats. Yeah.
Right. How do you explain some of the Democratic victories on Tuesday night? Like, for example, I'm talking to you from New Hampshire, where somehow the Republican tide seemed to have passed by New Hampshire completely. Gene Shaheen, thought to be in some kind of difficulty, was reelected to a second term.
Well, that race was also fairly close, but of course you had the factor of Scott Brown, a former Massachusetts state senator and then a federal senator in 2010 in a special election to fill Senator Ted Kennedy's vacancy, moving to New Hampshire and running as a candidate there. That turned off a lot of voters, and so he certainly lost, but it was down to the wire. It was a close race. And Shaheen, I think, like a lot of senators this time around, and she, of course, was more successful than any of them, focused on local issues. And that's what you really saw in this election, is that ultimately this was an election that was state by state and that really concentrated on specific state concerns. That's why, again, I think to the point that there is any kind of overarching national conversation that we had, it was the GOP's effort to link their Democratic opponents to President Obama. But that's not a policy you can put into a bill and pass. And so, again, I think when it comes to actually governing, there's no overarching policy mandate. And Republicans, if they're smart, are going to try to find common ground. And if they're not, as you know, we've seen historically, is what they do is they simply overreach, do too much, and then voters punish them for it next time.
In 2006, after the big Democratic victories in that midterm election, clearly President Bush was a lame duck president after 2006. And in the final 2 years of his presidency, many Republicans ran away from him. Now that clearly President Obama's a lame duck, I mean, we always knew he was a lame duck, but now with a Republican majority in both the House and Senate, does Obama become less relevant in the next 2 years, or is there some way that the Democrats could rally with the president and have a united front for 2016?
Well, I think in many respects it's up to him. So he has an opportunity, for instance, to put in place deportation relief for undocumented immigrants. It's something he's promised for a very long time to his Latino voters. He has yet to kind of unveil what that plan looks like. That, I think, will keep him relevant. At least it will have, you know, a real effect and a real consequence on voters' lives. And then, you know, there's a real chance chance, and we'll see what happens, to do some kind of tax reform, take a fresh look at our tax code. Representative Paul Ryan is probably going to be the next chairman of the House Ways and Means Committee, which is the committee that has jurisdiction over the tax code. And he said last night he wants to work on this with the president and wants to pass something serious that can get 60 votes in the Senate. That's a lot of bipartisan support. So there's really, I think, an opportunity if both parties are willing to find common ground and to actually get something done in these last 2 years.
What does your gut tell you the next 2 years? More gridlock, more of the same, or a potential for some kind of working relationship?
Well, look, I'm always the optimist, so I hope we get something done.
Igor Avolsky is the managing editor of thinkprogress.org. You can follow him on Twitter at Igor Avolsky, V-O-L-S-K-Y. Igor, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thank you.
It's time to reveal the answer to last week's trivia question and tell you who wins the coveted Political Junkie button. The question was, before Angus King of Maine and Bernie Sanders of Vermont, who was the last senator elected to his first term who won as neither a Democrat nor a Republican? And the answer is James Buckley of New York. In 1970, running on the Conservative Party line, Buckley defeated Republican incumbent Charles Goodell and Democrat Richard Ottinger. And the randomly chosen winner with the correct answer is Kent Coe of La Grande, Oregon. Kent is this week's grand winner. He gets the coveted Political Junkie button. And now to Scuttle Button, that weekly contest where we put up a series of buttons on our website, and your goal is to come up with a solution by picking out one word or concept per button. Here's the answer to last week's puzzle. The first one read, Mattis Matters. I have no idea where that's from. The next one is from 1968, extolling Ronald Reagan as California's favorite son. Then an anti-Nixon button that reads, Throw the Bum Out. Finally, a picture button of the 1932 Democratic presidential ticket, comprised of Franklin D. Roosevelt and John Nance Garner. So when you combine Mattis with son, with bum, with Garner, you get, well, Madison Bumgarner, this year's World Series most valuable player from the San Francisco Giants. And the winner is Paul Hughes of Sacramento, California. If you want to play along with our favorite weekly waste of time exercise, go to our website, krpoliticaljunkie.com, and click on Scuttle Button. Marijuana, abortion, the minimum wage, gun rights, all big decisions in the hands of the voters this election season instead of going through state legislatures. In some cases, these votes say a whole lot about states growing more ideologically divided and what a huge amount of change is happening at the state level. Here are the details of J.B. Wogan, a staff writer at Governing Magazine. J.B., welcome to the Political Junkie.
Thanks for having me on.
Let's start with marijuana. It was on the ballot in D.C., Oregon, Alaska, and Florida. Now, these were different ballot initiatives. They were different in the different states. What were the differences and how did they fare?
Right. So Washington State and Colorado actually were the first states to set up regulated markets for the sale of pot. And what Oregon and Alaska have done is they're following in the footsteps of Washington State and Colorado. D.C. is a little more scaled back. It allows for the legal possession of pot, very small amounts of pot, but not the sale. You could transfer it, but not sell it. The pot measures passed in Oregon and Alaska, although I should say that a medical marijuana ballot measure in Florida failed. It received a majority of the vote, 57%, but because it was a constitutional amendment, it had to get 60 or higher.
And what happened in D.C.?
In D.C., it passed.
Okay, now minimum wage was also on the ballot in four red states, Alaska, Arkansas, Nebraska, South Dakota. At least two of the states, Arkansas and Alaska, had really close or thought to have really close Senate battles. And basically, Democrats like to put minimum wage on the ballot to increase Democratic turnout. We also saw that in a non-binding resolution in Illinois. What happened with minimum wage around the country?
Yeah, this is part of a larger story where, you know, when you look at the national elections, you look at control of Congress, governor's races, even with the state legislature, the Republicans won big last night. But in terms of liberal causes, they did quite well on the ballot measures. And the minimum wage was sort of the epitome of that. You had four red states, as you mentioned, South Dakota, Arkansas, Alaska, and Nebraska, that were all looking at raising the minimum wage. Three of them actually had the same minimum wage as the federal requirement at $7.25. They all passed pretty overwhelmingly. And this is a good example of, I think, a tactic that we'll see more in the future, where unions and Democratic strategists try to bypass their legislatures and governors when they can't seem to get any action through their elected officials.
What about paid sick leave? That's another issue that progressives like to have on the ballot. What are those votes, and what do those votes say about the state of income inequality movement that is spreading around the country?
Yeah, absolutely. Massachusetts actually passed paid sick leave. This would be the third state law in the country to mandate paid sick leave for businesses. Connecticut did so in 2011, and California did it earlier this year. I should mention that in addition to the state laws, there are already a number of cities that have these laws on the books: Seattle, San Francisco, Jersey City, New Jersey. And last night, there were two more cities in New Jersey that passed paid sick leave ordinances. And the city of Oakland actually passed a combination measure that had both the minimum wage and paid sick leave on the same measure. I think, a lot of these ballot measures are a good testing ground for what I think we're going to see in terms of messaging and campaigning for the next election, the 2016 election. I think Democrats have already been feeling for ways to address the problems with income inequality. This compelling narrative that I think began with the Occupy movement, that the recovery after the Great Recession hadn't hit everybody the same, and that the very rich are getting richer while everyone else is seeing their wages sort of stagnate. The paid sick leave and the minimum wage are both responses to that. I think, it wouldn't surprise me if whoever ends up running for president for the Democrats ends up talking about paid sick leave and the minimum wage more.
What were your biggest takeaways with Tuesday's results?
One of the more interesting elections for me was the gun control measure in Washington State. That called for expanded background checks for all gun sales, not just for licensed dealers, but private sales, including over the internet and at gun shows. There's a lot of money poured into that race. Bill and Melinda Gates got involved. Steve Ballmer and his wife got involved. It was the only gun control measure that was on the ballot. And universal background checks was seen as sort of the most moderate of the gun control proposals back when President Obama and the Senate Democrats were talking about this. And now that it has passed, it passed 60 to 40, I think you're going to see other states taking this up. They're already talking about doing a similar ballot initiative in Nevada, where universal background checks passed through the legislature, but then Governor Sandoval vetoed it. So I think that there are some issues like universal background checks, like paid sick leave and the minimum wage, where it would not surprise me if these are only going to be taken up by more states and even become presidential election issues in the next 2 years.
Do you get a sense that with the public's frustration about what's going on in Congress or what's not going on in Congress, that could lead to more and more ballot initiatives and more people looking at that for the way to influence government policy?
Yes. I don't know about it, whether there'd be, say, more ballot initiatives, 2 years from now compared to this year. But I do think that for specific issues, minimum wage in particular, that advocates are going to be looking at the ballot box as a way of bypassing maybe elected representatives who are more reluctant to take on the issue. I think the minimum wage is a perfect example, where polling shows that the issue is most popular among Democrats, and then it's still pretty popular among independents, and then it polls around 50% or below 50%, depending on the state, for Republicans. Yet the majority of voters will in those states obviously are supporting raising the minimum wage. But it isn't a surprise that you would have to go to the voters, because the elected representatives feel, with their constituents, that they don't have much to lose by avoiding the issue.
It seems like more and more lawmakers oppose a minimum wage increase ballot initiative at their own peril.
I think that might be right. Yeah, it'll be interesting to see how Republicans who were elected in the same election cycle as the minimum wage hikes in those states, do they feel like there's a mandate to address economic inequality more generally? And in states that like Missouri, for example, is a state where there was a signature gathering effort that didn't actually come to fruition, but there was interest in raising the minimum wage there as well. You know, maybe Republican lawmakers will look and say, maybe this is something we should do before it ends up on the ballot.
J.B. Wogan is a staff writer at Governing Magazine. You can follow him on Twitter at J.B. Wogan, W-O-G-A-N. J.B., thanks for being on the show.
Thank you.
Welcome back to The Political Junkie. I'm Ken Rudin. It's time for This Week in Political History. If you turned on the TV on November 9th, 1993, you could have been watching Roseanne on ABC, Die Hard 2 on CBS, or Unsolved Mysteries on NBC. But 16 million people decided otherwise.
Welcome to a special edition of Larry King Live. The North American Free Trade Agreement.
They flipped over to CNN to watch a debate centered on hope and change.
We're not scared. We're not a nation of quitters. We're not a nation that is afraid to compete in the world marketplace. And when we face a choice as important as this one, it is extremely important that we make the right decision.
At the center of that debate, President Clinton's impending North American Free Trade Agreement, NAFTA. Before the debate, national support for the agreement to make a trade bloc with Canada and Mexico was under 40%. Enter Vice President Al Gore, 1992 independent presidential candidate Ross Perot, and moderator Larry King.
There's no time limit on questions or answers. The program will go 90 minutes. To be fair about deciding who got to sit where, we tossed a coin earlier today. Vice President won and chose the inside seat. Viewer calls will be screened. And
the goal for Gore and, to some extent, Perot wasn't really to sway those 16 million viewers. The true audience? 36 undecided House Democrats.
The best way to eliminate our influence down there is to defeat NAFTA. The best way to preserve it is to enter into this bargain, continue the lowering of the barriers. We've got a commitment that they're going to raise their minimum wage with productivity. We've got an agreement for the first time in history to use trade sanctions to compel the enforcement of their environmental standards. As they begin to develop and locate better jobs farther south, we cut down on illegal immigration.
How can the United States expect to compete on a long-term basis in an increasingly interdependent economic world while Europe and the PACRIM nations unite through their own respective trade alignments?
Very simple. We got the most productive workforce in the world. We're the biggest buyer of goods and services in the world. We're the market everybody wants to sell to. Our problem is we do the world's dumbest trade agreements. You go back to the agreements we've done all over the world, you'd be amazed that adults did them. We're about to do another one, but the American people have stopped it. It's dead in the House of Representatives. It's time we draw a line in the sand, and we've done it. Now, here's the key. You want to
just after the debate, the L.A. Times called the sparring between Gore and Perot chaotic, cross-firing Bosnia of the airwaves.
This has been a good deal for both Canada and the United States. Both have gained jobs. Both have gained trade flows. Both have become more competitive in the world marketplace as a result.
And there is a tooth fairy and there is an Easter bunny.
Bethesda, Maryland, hello.
CNN's Bruce Morton, NBC's Tim Russert, The Wall Street Journal's Al Hunt, and others all agreed that Gore's cool and collected argument won the day. Some newspapers call Perot petulant.
Those are the guys that cut the worst trade deals in history. He's already talked about
it. It's not over.
Wait
we'll
just
have,
a minute now.
They did the
Japanese deals. They did the Chinese deals. God bless them. They cost you two million jobs.
You think they fooled Colin Powell?
He's a great soldier. Doesn't know anything about business.
We'll have the vice president respond with Vice President Gore and Ross Perot after this.
But he couldn't.
After the 90-minute debate concluded, a poll showed 57% of Americans in favor of NAFTA. The House passed the legislation days later. Perot could count one victory, though. The phrase he coined in the 1992 election, giant sucking sound, was forever cemented into the political lexicon after the NAFTA debate.
Now, when you've got a 7-to-1 wage differential between the United States and Mexico, you will hear the giant sucking sound.
No, there's a political lesson.
The agreement went into effect January 1st, 1994, but it was November 9th, 1993, 21 years ago this week, that Vice President Al Gore sold NAFTA to the House and to millions of Americans on CNN's Larry King Live.
Thank you both for this historic evening. The vote in Congress is 8 days away. You'll be hearing lots more about it.
This has been This Week in Political History. I'm Ken Rudin.
Thanks for joining us and good night.
Campaign season is nothing without the ads, the attacks, the broken record talking points, and the subsequent fact checks. We'll put all the nastiness of the election season behind us, but not before we've talked about the biggest whoppers of the 2014 cycle. Here to walk us through it all is the Washington Post fact checker, Glenn Kessler. Glenn, welcome to the Political Junkie.
Thanks for having me.
You always refer to the Pinocchio system. Explain your Pinocchio system.
Well, it's kind of like a reverse restaurant review. You do better the less Pinocchios you get. One Pinocchio is, it might be mostly true, but it's a situation where someone is missing some context or done something slightly misleading. Two Pinocchios, it gets a bit more misleading. Sometimes politicians use words and phrases that twist what the actual facts are. When you get into three Pinocchios, you're really beginning to mislead people. Four Pinocchios is just an out-and-out whopper. And if you're really, really good, completely factual in the way you have made the statement, you get the rare Geppetto checkmark.
How often, when you give them four Pinocchios, how often do you hear from the campaigns? And I'm sure a lot of them are outraged.
They're outraged, but I think they're mostly used to it. In the 2012 campaign, someone actually wrote that among some political consultants, it was a badge of honor to get four Pinocchios because it meant that you were really pushing an envelope there.
Look, we're still coming down from the, I don't know if the high is the right word, but of the 2014 midterms. But some of the accusations, both in ads and during debates, have been just remarkable to watch. I always think of the one against Bruce Braley, the Democrat from Iowa who lost his bid for the Senate on Tuesday. He was in this debate with Joni Ernst, the Republican, accused of not being bipartisan. This is what Joni Ernst said in the debate.
Congressman, you threatened to sue a neighbor over chickens that came onto your property. You're talking about bipartisanship. How do we expect as Iowans to believe that you will work across the aisle when you can't walk across your yard?
That's just not true.
10 seconds. Gotta go.
It's just not true. I never threatened to sue anyone. It's not true.
Glenn, I remember watching that debate and saying, what in the world is going on?
Right. And I actually did a really extensive amount of reporting on this whole issue. This is an instance where I gave Ms. Ernst one Pinocchio, which meant it was kind of on target. And he says it's not true. But what actually happened, there was an instance where his neighbor at a vacation home let her chickens wander around. And rather than actually walking across the yard and talking to her about it, he and his wife filed a complaint with the homeowners association. And then on top of that, where the threatened to sue came from, he called up the lawyer for the homeowners association and said that he didn't want to get into a litigious situation, which is kind of lawyer code for, if you don't resolve this the way I want it, I might sue you. So, so she kind of stretched it a bit by saying he threatened to sue, but he certainly used language that might indicate he was threatening to sue. And on top of that, her overall point is, why didn't you just walk across the yard to talk about this with your neighbor? There was a ring of truth there, because in the case of the neighbor, when she went to offer some pears or apples, something like that, to the Braleys, they said, we're not going to take it from you because we've complained about your chickens.
There's also an ad from the New Hampshire Senate race where Gene Shaheen was reelected on Tuesday against Scott Brown. This ad was about abortion.
In Massachusetts, Scott Brown pushed for a law to force women considering abortion, force them to look at color photographs of developing fetuses. Scott Brown wants the government to tell women how to make this decision.
Now, Scott Brown, for his part, I mean, he argued that that's not true. He's a pro-choice Republican. What's the reality of that argument?
Well, again, this is an example of something that I ultimately determined was worthy of just one Pinocchio. The problem with the ad was it used the word forced. He got very upset at this ad because he does call himself a pro-choice Republican. He's very moderate on the issue. He's pro-choice, but he also sponsored or supported things that would restrict some access to abortion rights. And in this case, he did push for a law that put some roadblocks there on the way to getting an abortion, one of which was that, in effect, you would have had to look at a brochure which had these photographs that the ad talked about. Technically, it's not forcing you, but the doctors were required to go over the facts that were in the brochure, were required to ask you whether you had read the brochure. And so someone in that situation, in a real-life situation, they could, I guess they could say, I don't need to answer that. But most women would feel compelled to probably look at it. So that's why the Shaheen campaign felt justified in using the word forced. I didn't think it was enough to justify to use force, but the overall message of her ad was not totally out of line.
Some of the talking points that got a ton of attention were about Ebola. And here's one ad, the cut ad, as we call it, from the Agenda Project Action Fund.
Responding to an emerging infectious disease threat, this is particularly damaging.
Cut, cut.
That was the left hook.
Cut, cut, cut.
The right cross was the sequestration.
Cut, cut.
The NIH saw its budget slashed by $446 million.
Cut, cut,
cut.
I mean, basically, you're hearing Republicans say the word cut, and this is the accusation is that the Republicans are somehow responsible for Ebola because they were cutting the CDC budget and things like that.
Well, this is an ad that I gave four Pinocchios to. There were other Democratic talking points along this line that was part of that fact check. The fact of the matter is that there was a lot of funding that was increased in the Bush years. It did go flat in more recent years, but it was bipartisan. There were decisions made by President Obama, including budgets that he proposed that would have reduced the funding for NIH and CDC. To kind of pin it all on the Republicans was just very extreme and not supported by the facts.
There was also this defending coal argument, which was a big deal in the Senate races in Kentucky and I guess West Virginia, too. Listen to this ad from Alison Lundgren Grimes, the Democratic candidate for the Senate in Kentucky.
What Mitch McConnell doesn't want you to know is that he and his wife personally took $600,000 from anti-coal groups, including New York City Mayor Michael Bloomberg's Anti-Coal Foundation. The only candidate pocketing big money from people who want to destroy coal is Mitch McConnell.
This has got to be one of the most ridiculous assertions made during the campaign. And there's a similar ad, but in one in which Alison Grimes actually herself on camera makes this claim, and which they ran heavily throughout coal country. It didn't help her because she lost that whole area. But the whole notion of 600,000 from anti-coal groups is just absurd. It's not McConnell. It's his wife who was on a couple of boards, one of which is Bloomberg. But the main source of that money, the 600,000, was from being on the board of Wells Fargo. And Wells Fargo had curtailed some financing for strip mining, but they continue to finance coal companies. And in fact, the bank was completely mystified as to how they could be considered an anti-coal group. So what they did is they took a little bit of money from Bloomberg, again, not having nothing to do with coal, and then mixed it up with the $600,000 from Wells Fargo, which funds coal companies all the time, and turned it into this attack, which obviously fell flat.
There seems to be more fact-checking from people like yourself and others than ever before. Do you get a sense that this is stopping or curtailing candidates from stretching the truth, or is nothing going to change?
Well, I do think that fact-checking has an impact. I would say that what I find is that if a campaign feels they have a message that moves voters, they're going to use it no matter what the fact-checkers say. But there have been instances where candidates have adjusted their message or changed some of their language in response to concerns or complaints raised by fact-checkers. And it certainly puts more of a burden on the campaigns to justify the way they say these things. But as we were just talking about in that coal ad with Alison Grimes, even though I gave that first ad that you played for Pinocchio's, she went back and said it again herself on camera, because they must have had some polling that said this is going to help you with voters. In the end, it didn't, maybe because there was such a backlash against that ad that I had given Four Pinocchios to.
The 2014 campaign is over, and a lot of people are just so tired of the negative ads, they say just in time. But 2016 is right around the corner, isn't it?
It is. I can't wait.
Glenn Kessler is the Washington Post fact checker. You can follow him on Twitter at Glenn Kessler WP. Glenn, thanks for joining us.
You're welcome.
Before we go, it's easy to get caught up in the fast pace of election season. But just days before November 4th, you might have missed the news that longtime Boston Mayor Tom Menino passed away at the age of 71. Menino was the city's longest-serving mayor, serving from 1993 to 2014. He was also one of the most beloved and known mayors. It was said more than half the town had met Menino at one point or another.
I used to stop at three coffee shops in the morning. Just to talk to people. I don't drink coffee.
Yeah, I was going
to
say, you don't drink coffee.
No, but yeah. I want to see what they were talking about. And that's where you get your feelings of what you should be doing as a mayor.
Here to tell us why Menino was so loved and just what kind of a mayor he was is the Boston Globe's Andrew Ryan. He covers city politics at the Globe and has been there since 2006. Andrew, welcome to the Political Junkie.
Thanks very much for having me.
Tell me, before we get into Tom Menino, tell me, what was Boston like before he first took office in 1993?
So Boston was a very different place in 1993. It was a time, and this was happening nationally, where people were leaving the city. You know, for several decades, people had been fleeing to the suburbs, and Boston was still getting over explosive race relations in the 70s that lasted into the 80s. So Boston was a very different place than it is today.
And what kind of a candidate was Tom Menino? How did he present himself to the voters?
Well, he, in some ways, snuck in the back door. He, at the time, the mayor, Ray Flynn, there had been rumors that he was going to take an appointment in the Clinton administration. And so Tom Menino was a city councilor, and he became city council president. It was a very close vote. He won it 7-6, I believe. And as city council president, when Ray Flynn eventually was named ambassador to the Vatican, Tom Menino became acting mayor. So he had basically a jump start on the competition. He became mayor on July 12th, I think, 1993, and there was an election that November. So he basically got a test run at the job. And so people kind of assumed that he was going to be a caretaker, but he really used that time to his advantage and, immediately started to do things. And he kind of leveraged that to basically win the office and never let go of it for the next two decades.
Well, when you say that a lot of people thought he would be a caretaker, he was obviously very much underestimated. How come?
Well, he was not a telegenic politician. I mean, in his first campaign, he talked to, he always used the phrase that he was not a fancy talker. His nickname in office had become Mumbles. But he was a workhorse, and he was much more of a workhorse than a show horse. So what he did was he just showed up everywhere. He would show up to anything. He used to bring his own scissors to ribbon cuttings, and he would cut ribbons all over the city. So he would, as you heard from the clip, he would, stop at several coffee houses on the way into City Hall. He would go to kids' birthday parties. He, spent basically two decades going to everything he could possibly go to. And that's how he built relationships with people kind of one at a time.
He had said that his biggest accomplishments were reducing crime, improving education, boosting employment, plus, in addition to that, making the city more inclusive. How did he actually stack up?
I mean, I guess probably to some degree time will tell. What we know now is, when he took office in 1993, it was news that he was Italian. That was diversity because he wasn't Irish, because we had had a long string of Irish mayors. One of the things that he did in his career was, he had, tremendous support in communities of color. And we really saw that this week in the funeral services for him, that, you know, when and he had, tremendous support in the gay community. And that's partially because he was, you know, light years ahead of his time in terms of gay rights. He, you know, back in, you know, the mid 90s, he was, you know, boycotting the St. Patrick's Day parade because, you know, they wouldn't let, you know, openly gay marchers in. You know, when the state's highest court in Massachusetts legalized gay marriage in 2004, you know, when they were ahead of public opinion, it was not what we've seen, you know, the shift that we've seen today. But, you know, he actually, not only did he support it, but, you know, he rolled out the red carpet. You know, he was literally standing behind the first couple when they filled out their marriage applications, you know, which was a pretty significant thing for, you know, a devout Catholic who, you know, not only went to Mass every Sunday, but, you know, prayed all the time. Kind of, he championed underdogs a lot. That helped kind of define his 20 years in office.
He was much beloved, but he also had a reputation for holding grudges, being thin-skinned, and being tough with reporters. What was it like to report on him?
He was a master of the press. Definitely thin-skinned. He would certainly, you know, a lot of interviews would start with what was in that day's paper sometimes, you know, where he would, you know, take issue with, you know, how you presented one thing or another, but he was always good-humored about it. I covered his last term, so by the time I got to him, he was smart enough to, you know, a lot of times, like, some of the sharper criticism would come through aides and not necessarily through him. He was very good at kind of bringing reporters into his fold. He used to call me down to his office regularly, you know, late in the day, and sometimes it was about a story, sometimes it was not, but sometimes just kind of talk about things in the city for a while. So he was very good at kind of managing the press. There's a lot of times that things would slip out of his mouth that would make news, and I don't think it was ever unintentional. He knew how to drive media coverage in this town, and he did it very well.
What would you say that some of the stuff that he did was bad, was not so good?
He certainly could hold grudges. You know, I think that those have been well documented. Schools, like all cities, I mean, you know, urban education has not been solved here in Boston. Certainly have been some strides that were made, but there's still a lot of work that needs to be done on schools. He was always criticized for not having a grand vision. And, you know, he had this the quote which led our obituary of him was, you know, that visionaries don't get things done. You know, and I think that there is some truth in that, but I think there were certain times where he would propose things that where he was looking for some sizzle or a headline, and it, you know, then kind of didn't work out. Like, he'd proposed building a 1,000-foot tower, and he wanted to build something big on City Hall Plaza, and, you know, hadn't really, so he made this big announcement, but really hadn't investigated well. And I think the FAA and was against it, and the federal government, because there was a federal building next door, was against it. So sometimes things would come out half-baked. If you look at a 20-year career, he probably had a pretty good batting average if you were going to weigh everything all together. Now, I was not here in 1993, but if you just even look at just census data, that the city has gone from shrinking to growing, and, you know, and we've grown pretty significantly. I mean, some of the things that he and his aides kind of took the most pride in, like, you know, race relations. I mean, those are things that are much harder to measure, but they say that was one of his, you know, that his most significant legacies was that race relations in Boston have improved significantly.
What will you remember most about him?
I mean, probably one of his greatest skills was getting people to underestimate him. And, you know, and part of that was from him being because he wasn't all that articulate. And so I think people would, you know, kind of write him off sometimes. I mean, sometimes he would have these little tricks, like, you know, sometimes I think he would pretend he couldn't hear questions and then would, you know, kind of say, you know, there were a very sharp, like, what would come out of his mouth to kind of catch you off guard. And a lot of times I think it was manufactured. He was a very, very sharp man who, you know, and I think that I'll miss. And, you know, in his sense of humor, he loved to gossip. He loved to find out what was happening in the city and, you know, what I had heard. And what he prided himself on, you know, being very much on the pulse of the city, both, you know, in terms of in the neighborhoods and then kind of political gossip.
Andrew Ryan is a city reporter for the Boston Globe. You can follow him on Twitter at @GlobeAndrewRyan. Andrew, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
That's it for this week's show. Political Junkie is made possible by the generous folks at WAMU 88.5 in Washington and PRX, the Public Radio Exchange. Also, thanks this week to the great team here at New Hampshire Public Radio, who have so generously hosted me for their election coverage. If you've got comments, questions, or complaints, send an email to ken@krpoliticaljunkie.com. You could also send us a tweet at Ken Rudin and at Ken Rudin Junkie, or shoot us a message on Facebook. Just search for The Political Junkie. To subscribe to the podcast, check out our Scuttle Button puzzles, see our Instagram button of the day, and my exclusive columns, stop by krpoliticaljunkie.com. Our producer and editor is A.D. Quigg. Douglas Bell is our coordinating producer and engineer, and Kristen Sorensen is our consultant. Our engineer at New Hampshire Public Radio is the invaluable Andrew Perella. I'm Ken Rudin in Concord. Thanks for listening. See you next week.